and through it blew a black wind of loss, in which things cherished and consecrated throughout the stone down seemed to flicker and go out. As he listened, Covenant felt that the entire gathering wept with the song, cried out as one in silent woe under the wide power of the singer. But grief did not remain long in that voice. After a pause that opened in the night like a revelation, Atiaran broke into her brave refrain, "Beric, Earth Friend," and the change carried her high in a major modulation that would have been too wrenching for any voice less rampant with suggestions, less thickly woven than hers. The emotion of the gathering continued, but it was reborn in an instant from grief to joy and gratitude. And as Atiaran's long, last high note sprang from her throat like a salute to the mountains and the stars, the people held up their graveling pots and gave a resounding shout, "Beric, Earth Friend, hail!" Then slowly they lowered their lights and began to press forward, moving closer to Atiaran to hear her story. The common impulse was so simple and strong that Covenant took a few steps as well before he could recollect himself. Abruptly he looked about him, focused his eyes on the faint glimmering stars, smelled the pervasive aroma of the graveling. The unanimous reaction of the stone down frightened him. He could not afford to lose himself in it. He wanted to turn away, but he needed to hear Beric's story, so he stayed where he was. As soon as the people had settled themselves, Atiaran began. "It came to pass that there was a great war in the eldest days, in the age that marks the beginning of the memory of mankind. Before the old lords were born, before the giants came across the sun-birthed sea to make the alliance of rock brothers, a time before the oath of peace, before the desolation and High Lord Kevin's last battle. It was a time when the Vials who sired the Demondim were a high and lofty race, and the Cave Whites smithed and smelted beautiful metals to trade in open friendship with all the people of the land. In that time, the land was one great nation, and over it ruled a king and queen. They were a hail pair, rich with love and honor, and for many years they held their sway in unison and peace. But after a time, a shadow came over the heart of the king. He tasted the power of life and death over those who served him and learned to desire it. Soon mastery became a lust with him, as necessary as food. His nights were spent in dark quests for more power, and by day he exercised that power, becoming hungrier and more cruel as the lust overcame him. But the queen looked on her husband and was dismayed. She desired only that the health and fealty of the past years should return. But no appeal, no suasion or power of hers could break the grip of cruelty that degraded the king. And at last, when she saw that the good of the land would surely die if her husband were not halted, she broke with him, opposed his might with hers. Then there was war in the land. Many who had felt the cut of the king's lash stood with the queen, and many who hated murder and loved life joined her also. The chiefest of these was Beric, strongest and wisest of the queen's champions. But the fear of the king was upon the land, and whole cities rose up to fight for him, killing to protect their own slavery. Battle was joined across the land, and for a time it seemed that the queen would prevail. Her heroes were mighty of hand, and none were mightier than Beric, who was said to be a match for any king. But as the battle raged, a shadow, a gray cloud from the east, fell over the hosts. The queen's defenders were stricken at heart, and their strength left them. But her enemies found a power of madness in the shadow. They forgot their humanity. They chopped and trampled and clawed and bit and maimed and defiled until their gray onslaught whelmed the heroes, and Beric's comrades broke one by one into despair and death. So the battle went until Beric was the last hater of the shadow left alive. But he fought on, heedless of his fate and the number of his foes, and souls fell dead under his sword like autumn leaves in a gale. At last, the king himself, filled with the fear and madness of the shadow, challenged Beric, and they fought. Beric stroked mightily, but the shadow turned his blade. So the contest was balanced until one blow of the king's axe cleft Beric's hand. Then Beric's sword fell to the ground, and he looked about him, looked and saw the shadow, and all his brave comrades dead. He cried a great cry of despair, and turning, fled the battleground. Thus he ran, hunted by death, and the memory of the shadow was upon him. For 3 days he ran, never stopping, never resting, and for 3 days the king's host came behind him like a murderous beast, panting for blood. At the last of his strength and the extremity of his despair, he came to Mount Thunder. Climbing the rock-strewn slope, he threw himself down atop a great boulder and wept, saying, "Alas for the earth! We are overthrown and have no friend to redeem us. Beauty shall pass utterly from the land." But the rock on which he lay replied, "There is a friend for a heart with the wisdom to see it." "The stones are not my friends," cried Beric. "See, my enemies ride the land, and no convulsion tears the earth from under their befouling feet." "That may be," said the rock. "They are alive as much as you, and need the ground to stand upon. Yet there is a friend for you in the earth, if you will pledge your soul to its healing." Then Beric stood upon the rock and beheld his enemies close upon him. He took the pledge, sealing it with the blood of his riven hand. The earth replied with thunder. From the heights of the mountain came great stone fire lions, devouring everything in their path. The king and all his host were laid waste, and Beric alone stood above the rampage on his boulder like a tall ship in the sea. When the rampage had passed, Beric did homage to the lions of Mount Thunder, promising respect and communion and service for the earth from himself and all the generations which followed him upon the land. Wielding the first earth power, he made the staff of law from the wood of the one tree, and with it began the healing of the land. In the fullness of time, Beric Halfhand was given the name Heartthew, and he became the Lord Fatherer, the first of the old lords. Those who followed his path flourished in the land for 2,000 years. For a long moment there was silence over the gathering when Atyaran finished. Then together, as if their pulses moved to a single beat, the stone downers began to surge forward, stretching out their hands to touch her in appreciation. She spread her arms to hug as many of her friends as she could, and those who could not reach her embraced each other, sharing the oneness of their communal response. Chapter 7. Lena. Alone in the night, alone because he could not share the spontaneous, embracing impulse of the stone down, Covenant felt suddenly trapped, threatened. A pressure of darkness cramped his lungs. He could not seem to get enough air. A leper's claustrophobia was on him, a leper's fear of crowds, of unpredictable behavior. "Beric," he panted with mordant intensity. These people wanted him to be a hero. With a stiff jerk of repudiation, he swung away from the gathering, went stalking in high dudgeon between the houses as if the stone downers had dealt him a mortal insult. "Beric!" His chest heaved at the thought. Wild magic. It was ridiculous. Did not these people know he was a leper? Nothing could be less possible for him than the kind of heroism they saw in Beric Halfhand. But Lord Fowl had said, "He intends you to be my final foe. He chose you to destroy me." In stark dismay, he glimpsed the end toward which the path of the dream might be leading him. He saw himself drawn ineluctably into a confrontation with the despiser. He was trapped. Of course, he could not play the hero in some dream war. He could not forget himself that much. Forgetfulness was suicide. Yet he could not escape this dream without passing through it, could not return to reality without awakening. He knew what would happen to him if he stood still and tried to stay sane. Already, only this far from the lights of the gathering, he felt dark night beating toward him, circling on broad wings out of the sky at his head. He lurched to a halt, stumbled to lean against a wall, caught his forehead in his hands. "I can't," he panted. All his hopes that this land might conjure away his impotence, heal his sore heart, somehow fell into ashes. "Can't go on. Can't stop. What's happening to me?" Abruptly, he heard steps running toward him. He jumped erect and saw Lena hurrying to join him. The swing of her graveling pot cast mad shadows across her figure as she moved. In a few more strides, she slowed, then stopped, holding her pot so that she could see him clearly. "Thomas Covenant," she asked, tentatively, "are you not well?" "No," he lashed at her, "I'm not well. Nothing's well, and it hasn't been since..." The words caught in his throat for an instant. "Since I was divorced." He glared at her, defying her to ask what a divorce was. The way she held her light left most of her face in darkness. He could not see how she took his outburst. But some inner sensitivity seemed to guide her. When she spoke, she did not aggravate his pain with crude questions or condolences. Softly, she said, "I know a place where you may be alone." He nodded sharply. "Yes." He felt that his distraught nerves were about to snap. His throat was thick with violence. He did not want anyone to see what happened to him. Gently, Lena touched his arm, led him away from the stone down toward the river. Under the dim starlight, they reached the banks of the Mythil, then turned downriver. In half a mile, they came to an old stone bridge that gleamed with a damp, black reflection, as if it had just arisen from the water for Covenant's use. The suggestiveness of that thought made him stop. He saw the span as a kind of threshold. Crises lurked in the dark hills beyond the far riverbank. Abruptly, he asked, "Where are we going?" He was afraid that if he crossed that bridge, he would not be able to recognize himself when he returned. "To the far side," Lena said. "There you may be alone. Our people do not often cross the Mythil. It is said that the Western Mountains are not friendly, that the ill of Doom's retreat which lies behind them has bent their spirit. But I have walked over all the Western Valley, stone-questing for Suru-Pamaral images, and have met no harm. There is a place nearby where you will not be disturbed." For all its appearance of age, the bridge had an untrustworthy look to Covenant's eye. The unmortared joints seemed tenuous, held together only by dim, treacherous, star-cast shadows. When he stepped onto the bridge, he expected his foot to slip, the stones to tremble, but the arch was steady. At the top of the span, he paused to lean on the low side wall of the bridge and gaze down at the river. The water flowed blackly under him, grumbling over its long prayer for absolution in the sea. And he looked into it as if he were asking it for courage. Could he not simply ignore the things that threatened him, ignore the opposing impossibilities, madnesses of his situation, return to the stone down and pretend with blithe guile that he was Beric Halfhand reborn? He could not. He was a leper. There were some lies he could not tell. With a sharp twist of nausea, he found that he was pounding his fists on the wall. He snatched his hands up, tried to see if he had injured himself, but the dim stars showed him nothing. Grimacing, he turned and followed Lena down to the western bank of the Mythil. Soon they reached their destination. Lena led Covenant directly west for a distance, then up a steep hill to the right and down a splintered ravine toward the river again. Carefully, they picked their way along the ragged bottom of the ravine as if they were balancing on the broken keel of a ship. Its shattered hull rose up on either side of them, narrowing their horizons. A few trees struck out of the sides like spars, and near the river the hulk lay aground on a swath of smooth sand which faded toward a flat rock promontory jutting into the river. The Mythil complained around this rock, as if annoyed by the brief constriction of its banks, and the sound blew up the ravine like a sea breeze moaning through a reefed wreck. Lena halted on the sandy bottom. Kneeling, she scooped a shallow basin in the sand and emptied her pot of graveling into it. The firestones gave more light from the open basin, so that the ravine bottom was lit with yellow, and shortly Covenant felt a quiet warmth from the graveling. The touch of the stone's glow made him aware that the night was cool, a pleasant night for sitting around a fire. He squatted beside the graveling with a shiver like the last keen quivering of imminent hysteria. After she had settled the graveling in the sand, Lena moved away toward the river. Where she stood on the promontory, the light barely reached her and her form was dark, but Covenant could see that her face was raised to the heavens. He followed her gaze up the black face of the mountains and saw that the moon was rising. A silver sheen paled the stars along the rim of rock, darkening the valley with its shadow. But the shadow soon passed down the ravine, and moonlight fell on the river, giving it the appearance of old argent. And as the full moon arose from the mountains, it caught Lena, cast a white haze like a caress across her head and shoulders. Standing still by the river, she held her head up to the moon, and Covenant watched her with an odd, grim jealousy, as if she were poised on a precipice that belonged to him. Finally, when the moonlight had crossed the river into the eastern valley, Lena lowered her head and returned to the circle of the graveling. Without meeting Covenant's gaze, she asked softly, "Shall I go?" Covenant's palms itched as if he wanted to strike her for even suggesting that she might stay. But at the same time, he was afraid of the night. He did not want to face it alone. Awkwardly, he got to his feet, paced a short distance away from her. Scowling up the hulk of the ravine, he fought to sound neutral as he said, "What do you want?" Her reply, when it came, was quiet and sure. "I want to know more of you." He winced, ducked his head as if claws had struck at him out of the air. Then he snatched himself erect again. "Ask. Are you married?" At that, he whirled to face her as if she had stabbed him in the back. Under the hot distress of his eyes and his bared teeth, she faltered, lowered her eyes, and turned her head away. Seeing her uncertainty, he felt that his face had betrayed him again. He had not willed the snarling contortion of his features. He wanted to contain himself, not give way like this, not in front of her. Yet she aggravated his distress more than anything else he had encountered. Striving for self-control, he snapped, "Yes. No. Doesn't matter. Why ask?" Under his glare, Lena dropped to the sand, sat on her feet by the graveling, and watched him obliquely from beneath her eyebrows. When she said nothing immediately, he began to pace up and down the swath of sand. As he moved, he turned and pulled fiercely at his wedding ring. After a moment, Lena answered with an air of irrelevance, "There is a man who desires to marry me. He is Triok, son of Thuler. Though I am not of age, he woos me, so that when the time comes, I will make no other choice. But if I were of age now, I would not marry him. Oh, he is a good man in his way, a good cattle herd, courageous in defense of his kine. And he is taller than most. But there are too many wonders in the world, too much power to know and beauty to share and to create. And I have not seen the run-in. I could not marry a cattle herd who desires no more than a Surupamaro for wife. Rather, I would go to the Lorsrat, as Atiyaran my mother did, and I would stay and not falter, no matter what trials the lore put upon me, until I became a lord. It is said that such things may happen. Do you think so? Covenant scarcely heard her. He was pacing out his agitation on the sand, enraged and undercut by an unwanted memory of Joan. Beside his lost love, Lena and the silver knight of the land failed of significance. The hollowness of his dream became suddenly obvious to his inner view, like an unveiled wilderland, a new permutation of the desolation of leprosy. This was not real. It was a torment that he inflicted upon himself in subconscious, involuntary revolt against his disease and loss. To himself he groaned, "Is it being outcast that does this? Is being cut off such a shock? By hell, I don't need any more." He felt that he was on the edge of screaming. In an effort to control himself, he dropped to the sand with his back to Lena and hugged his knees as hard as he could. Careless of the unsteadiness of his voice, he asked, "How do your people marry?" In an uncomplicated tone, she said, "It is a simple thing, when a man and a woman choose each other. After the two have become friends, if they wish to marry, they tell the circle of elders. And the elders take a season to assure themselves that the friendship of the two is secure, with no hidden jealousy or failed promise behind them to disturb their course in later years. Then the stone down gathers in the center, and the elders take the two in their arms and ask, 'Do you wish to share life, in joy and sorrow, work and rest, peace and struggle, to make the land new?' The two answer, 'Life with life, we choose to share the blessings and the service of the earth.'" For a moment, her starlit voice paused reverently. Then she went on, "The stone down shouts together, 'It is good. Let there be life and joy and power while the years last.' Then the day is spent in joy, and the new mates teach new games and dances and songs to the people, so that the happiness of the stone down is renewed, and communion and pleasure do not fail in the land." She paused again shortly before continuing, "The marriage of Atiyaran, my mother, with Trell, my father, was a bold day. The elders who teach us have spoken of it many times. Every day in the season of assurance, Trell climbed the mountains, searching forgotten paths and lost caves, hidden falls and new broken crevices for a stone of Orcrest, a precious and many-powered rock. For there was a drought upon the South Plains at that time, and the life of the stone down faltered in famine. Then, on the eve of the marriage, he found his treasure, a piece of Orcrest, smaller than a fist. And in the time of joy, after the speaking of the rituals, he and Atiyaran, my mother, saved the stone down. While she sang a deep prayer to the earth, a song known in the Lorsrat, but long forgotten among our people, he held the Orcrest in his hand and broke it with the strength of his fingers. As the stone fell into dust, thunder rolled between the mountains, though there were no clouds, and one bolt of lightning sprang from the dust in his hand. Instantly the blue sky turned black with thunderheads, and the rain began to fall. So the famine was broken, and the stone downers smiled on the coming days like a people reborn." Though he clenched his legs with all his strength, Covenant could not master his dizzy rage. "Joan." Lena's tale struck him like a mockery of his pains and failures. "I can't. For a moment, his lower jaw shuddered under the effort he made to speak. Then he leaped up and dashed toward the river. As he covered the short distance, he bent and snatched a stone out of the sand. Springing onto the promontory, he hurled the stone with all the might of his body at the water. "Can't!" A faint splash answered him, but at once the sound died under the heedless plaint of the river, and the ripples were swept away. Softly at first, Covenant said to the river, "I gave Joan a pair of riding boots for a wedding present." Then, shaking his fists wildly, he shouted, "Riding boots! Does my impotence surprise you?" Unseen and incomprehending, Lena arose and moved toward Covenant, one hand stretched out as if to soothe the violence knotted in his back. But she paused a few steps away from him, searching for the right thing to say. After a moment, she whispered, "What happened to your wife?" Covenant's shoulders jerked. Thickly, he said, "She's gone." "How did she die?" "Not her. Me. She left me. Divorced. Terminated. When I needed her." Indignantly, Lena wondered, "Why would such a thing happen while there is life?" "I'm not alive," she heard fury climbing to the top of his voice. "I'm a leper. Outcast, unclean. Lepers are ugly and filthy. And abominable." His words filled her with horror and protest. "How can it be?" she moaned. "You are not abominable. What world is it that dares treat you so?" His muscles jumped still higher in his shoulders, as if his hands were locked on the throat of some tormenting demon. "It's real. That is reality. Fact. The kind of thing that kills you if you don't believe it." With a gesture of rejection toward the river, he gasped, "This is a nightmare." Lena flared with sudden courage. "I do not believe it. It may be that your world, but the land is real." Covenant's back clenched abruptly still, and he said with preternatural quietness, "Are you trying to drive me crazy?" His ominous tone startled her, chilled her. For an instant, her courage stumbled. She felt the river and the ravine closing around her like the jaws of a trap. Then Covenant whirled and struck her a stinging slap across the face. The force of the blow sent her staggering back into the light of the graveling. He followed quickly, his face contorted in a wild grin. As she caught her balance, got one last, clear, terrified look at him, she felt sure that he meant to kill her. The thought paralyzed her. She stood dumb and helpless while he approached. Reaching her, he knotted his hands in the front of her shift and rent the fabric like a veil. She could not move. For an instant, he stared at her high, perfect breasts and her short slip, with grim triumph in his eyes, as though he had just exposed some foul plot. Then he gripped her shoulder with his left hand and tore away her slip with his right, forcing her down to the sand as he uncovered her. Now she wanted to resist, but her limbs would not move. She was helpless with anguish. A moment later, he dropped the burden of his weight on her chest, and her loins were stabbed with a wild white fire that broke her silence, made her scream. But even as she cried out, she knew that it was too late for her. Something that her people thought of as a gift had been torn from her. But Covenant did not feel like a taker. His climax flooded him as if he had fallen into a mithril of molten fury. Suffocating in passion, he almost swooned. Then time seemed to pass him by, and he lay still for moments that might have been hours for all he knew, hours during which his world could have crumbled unheeded. At last he remembered the softness of Lena's body under him, felt the low shake of her sobbing. With an effort, he heaved himself up and to his feet. When he looked down at her in the graveling light, he saw the blood on her loins. Abruptly, his head became giddy, unbalanced, as though he were peering over a precipice. He turned and hurried with a shambling, unsteady gait toward the river, pitched himself flat on the rock, and vomited the weight of his guts into the water. And the Mithil erased his vomit as cleanly as if nothing had happened. He lay still on the rock while the exhaustion of his exacerbated nerves overcame him. He did not hear Lena arise, gather the shreds of her clothing, speak, or climb away out of the shattered ravine. He heard nothing but the long lament of the river, saw nothing but the ashes of his burnt-out passion, felt nothing but the dampness of the rock on his cheeks like tears. Chapter 8. The Dawn of the Message. The hard bones of the rock slowly brought Thomas Covenant out of dreams of close embraces. For a time he drifted on the rising current of the dawn, surrounded on his ascetic, sufficient bed by the searching self-communion of the river, the fresh odors of day, the wheeling cries of birds as they sprang into the sky. While his self-awareness returned, he felt at peace, harmonious with his context. And even the uncompromising hardness of the stone seemed apposite to him, a proper part of a whole morning. His first recollections of the previous night were of orgasm, heart-rending, easing, release, and satisfaction so precious that he would have been willing to coin his soul to make such things part of his real life. For a long moment of joy, he re-experienced that sensation. Then he remembered that to get it, he had hurt Lena. Lena! He rolled over, sat up in the dawn. The sun had not yet risen above the mountains, but enough light reflected into the valley from the plains for him to see that she was gone. She had left her fire burning in the sand up the ravine from him. He lurched to his feet, scanned the ravine and both banks of the Mithil for some sign of her, or, his imagination leaped, of stone downers seeking vengeance. His heart thudded. All those rock-strong people would not be interested in his explanations or apologies. He searched for evidence of pursuit like a fugitive. But the dawn was as undisturbed as if it contained no people, no crimes or desires for punishment. Gradually, Covenant's panic receded. After a last look around, he began to prepare for whatever lay ahead of him. He knew that he should get going at once, hurry along the river toward the relative safety of the plains. But he was a leper and could not undertake solitary journeys lightly. He needed to organize himself. He did not think about Lena. He knew instinctively that he could not afford to think about her. He had violated her trust, violated the trust of the stone down. That was as close to his last night's rage as he could go. It was past, irrevocable, and illusory, like the dream itself. With an effort that made him tremble, he put it behind him. Almost by accident on Kevin's watch, he had discovered the answer to all such insanity. Keep moving. Don't think about it. Survive. That answer was even more necessary now. His barrack fear of the previous evening seemed relatively unimportant. His resemblance to a legendary hero was only a part of a dream, not a compulsory fact or demand. He put it behind him also. Deliberately, he gave himself a thorough scrutiny and VSE. When he was sure that he had no hidden injuries, no dangerous purple spots, he moved out to the end of the promontory. He was still trembling. He needed more discipline, mortification. His hands shook as if they could not steady themselves without his usual shaving ritual. But the penknife in his pocket was inadequate for shaving. After a moment, he took a deep breath, gripped the edge of the rock, and dropped himself, clothes and all, into the river for a bath. The current tugged at him seductively, urging him to float off under blue skies into a spring day. But the water was too cold. He could only stand the chill long enough to duck and thrash in the stream for a moment. Then he hauled himself onto the rock and stood up, blowing spray off his face. Water from his hair kept running into his eyes, blinding him momentarily to the fact that Atiyaran stood on the sand by the graveling. She contemplated him with a grave, firm glance. Covenant froze, dripping as if he had been caught in the middle of a flagrant act. For a moment, he and Atiyaran measured each other across the sand and rock. When she started to speak, he cringed inwardly, expecting her to revile, denounce, hurl imprecations. But she only said, "Come to the graveling. You must dry yourself." In surprise, he scrutinized her tone with all the high alertness of his senses, but he could hear nothing in it except determination and quiet sadness. Suddenly he guessed that she did not know what had happened to her daughter. Breathing deeply to control the labor of his heart, he moved forward and huddled down next to the graveling. His mind raced with improbable speculations to account for Atiyaran's attitude, but he kept his face to the warmth and remained silent, hoping that she would say something to let him know where he stood with her. Almost at once she murmured, "I knew where to find you. Before I returned from speaking with the Circle of Elders, Lena told Trell that you were here." She stopped, and Covenant forced himself to ask, "Did he see her?" He knew that it was a suspicious question, but Atiyaran answered simply, "No, she went to spend the night with a friend. She only called out her message as she passed our home." Then for several long moments, Covenant sat still and voiceless, amazed by the implications of what Lena had done. Only called out. At first, his brain reeled with thoughts of relief. He was safe, temporarily at least. With her reticence, Lena had purchased precious time for him. Clearly, the people of this land were prepared to make sacrifices. After another moment, he understood that she had not made her sacrifice for him. He could not imagine that she cared for his personal safety. No, she chose to protect him because he was a barrack figure, a bearer of messages to the lords. She did not want his purpose to be waylaid by the retribution of the Stone Down. This was her contribution to the defense of the land from Lord Fowl the Grey Slayer. It was a heroic contribution. In spite of his discipline, his fear, he sensed the violence Lena had done herself for the sake of his message. He seemed to see her huddling naked behind a rock in the foothills throughout that bleak night, shunning for the first time in her young life the open arms of her community, bearing the pain and shame of her riven body alone so that he would not be required to answer for it. An unwanted memory of the blood on her loins writhed in him. His shoulders bunched to strangle the thought. Through locked teeth, he breathed to himself, "I've got to go to the council." When he had steadied himself, he asked grimly, "What did the elders say?"
"There was little for them to say," she replied in a flat voice. "I told them what I know of you, and of the land's peril. They agreed that I must guide you to Lord's Keep. For that purpose I have come to you now. See," she indicated two packs lying near her feet, "I am ready. Trell, my husband, has given me his blessing. It grieves me to go without giving my love to Lena, my daughter, but time is urgent. You have not told me all your message, but I sense that from this day forward each delay is hazardous. The elders will give thought to the defense of the plains. We must go."
Covenant met her eyes, and this time he understood the sad determination in them. She was afraid, and did not believe that she would live to return to her family. He felt a sudden pity for her. Without fully comprehending what he said, he tried to reassure her. Things aren't as bad as they might be. A cave wight has found the staff of law, and I gather he doesn't really know how to use it. Somehow the lords have got to get it away from him. But his attempt miscarried. Atiaran stiffened and said, "Then the life of the land is in our speed. Alas that we cannot go to the Ranahin for help. But the Ramen have little countenance for the affairs of the land, and no Ranahin has been ridden, save by lord or bloodguard, since the age began. We must walk, Thomas Covenant, and Revelstone is 300 long leagues distant. Is your clothing dry? We must be on our way." Covenant was ready. He had to get away from this place. He gathered himself to his feet and said, "Fine, let's go." However, the look that Atiaran gave him as he stood held something unresolved. In a low voice, as if she were mortifying herself, she said, "Do you trust me to guide you, Thomas Covenant? You do not know me. I failed in the Lore's Rot." Her tone seemed to imply not that she was undependable, but that he had the right to judge her. But he was in no position to judge anyone. "I trust you," he rasped. "Why not? You said yourself..." He faltered, then forged ahead. "You said yourself that I come to save or damn the land." "True," she returned simply. "But you do not have the stink of a servant of the Grey Slayer. My heart tells me that it is the fate of the land to put faith in you, for good or ill." "Then let's go." He took the pack that Atiaran lifted toward him and shrugged his shoulders into the straps. But before she put on her own pack, she knelt to the graveling in the sand. Passing her hands over the firestones, she began a low humming, a soft tune that sounded ungainly in her mouth, as if she were unaccustomed to it, and under her waving gestures, the yellow light faded. In a moment, the stones had lapsed into a pale, pebbly gray, as if she had lulled them to sleep, and their heat dissipated. When they were cold, she scooped them into their pot, covered it, and stored it in her pack. The sight reminded Covenant of all the things he did not know about this dream. As Atiaran got to her feet, he said, "There's only one thing I need. I want you to talk to me. Tell me all about the Lore's Rot and the Lords and everything I might be interested in." Then, because he could not give her the reason for his request, he concluded lamely, "It'll pass the time." With a quizzical glance at him, she settled her pack on her shoulders. "You are strange, Thomas Covenant. I think you are too eager to know my ignorance. But what I know, I will tell you. Though without your raiment and speech, it would pass my belief to think you an utter stranger to the land. Now come. There are treasure berries aplenty along our way this morning. They will serve as breakfast. The food we carry must be kept for the chances of the road." Covenant nodded and followed her as she began climbing out of the ravine. He was relieved to be moving again, and the distance passed quickly. Soon they were down by the river, approaching the bridge. Atiaran strode straight onto the bridge, but when she reached the top of the span, she stopped. A moment after Covenant joined her, she gestured north along the middle toward the distant plains. "I tell you openly, Thomas Covenant," she said, "I do not mean to take a direct path to Lord's Keep. The keep is west of north from us, 300 leagues as the eye sees across the center plains of the land. There many people live, in Stonedown and Woodhelven, and it might chance that both road and help could be found to take us where we must go. But we could not hope for horses. They are rare in the land, and few folk but those of Revelstone know them.
It is in my heart that we may save time by journeying north, across the Mithil when it swings east, and so into the land of Andalane, where the fair hills are the flower of all the beauties of the earth. There we will reach the Soul's Ease River, and it may be that we will find a boat to carry us up that sweet stream, past the westland of Trothgard, where the promises of the Lords are kept, to great Revelstone itself, the Lord's Keep. All travelers are blessed by the currents of the Soul's Ease, and our journey will end sooner if we find a carrier there. But we must pass within 50 leagues of Mount Thunder. Gravin Threndor. As she said the ancient name, a shiver seemed to run through her voice. It is there, or nowhere, that the Staff of Law has been found, and I do not wish to go even as close as Andalane to the wrong wielder of such might. She paused for a moment, hesitating, then went on, There would be rue unending if a corrupt Cavewight gained possession of the ring you bear. The evil ones are quick to unleash such forces as wild magic. And even were the Cavewight unable to use the ring, I fear that Urvyles still live under Mount Thunder. They are lore-wise creatures, and white gold would not surpass them. But time rides urgently on us, and we must save it where we may. And there is another reason for seeking the passage of Andalane at this time of year, if we hasten. But I should not speak of it. You will see it and rejoice if no ill befall us on our way. She fixed her eyes on Covenant, turning all their inward strength on him so that he felt, as he had the previous evening, that she was searching for his weaknesses. He feared that she would discover his night's work in his face, and he had to force himself to meet her gaze until she said, Now tell me, Thomas Covenant, will you go where I lead? Feeling both shamed and relieved, he answered, Let's get on with it. I'm ready. That is well. She nodded, started again toward the east bank. But Covenant spent a moment looking down at the river. Its soft plaint sounded full of echoes, and they seemed to moan at him with serene irony, Does my impotence surprise you? A cloud of trouble darkened his face, but he clenched himself, rubbed his ring, and stalked away after Atiaran, leaving the Mithil to flow on its way like a stream of forgetfulness or a border of death. As the sun climbed over the eastern mountains, Atiaran and Covenant were moving north, downstream along the river toward the open plains. At first they traveled in silence. Covenant was occupied with short forays into the hills to his right, gathering Aliantha. He found their tangy peach flavor as keenly delicious as before. A fine essence in their juice made hunger and taste into poignant sensations. He refrained from taking all the berries off any one bush. He had to range away from Atiaran's sternly forward track often to get enough food to satisfy him, and he scattered the seeds faithfully, as Lena had taught him. Then he had to trot to catch up with Atiaran. In this way he passed nearly a league, and when he finished eating, the valley was perceptibly broader. He made one last side trip, this time to the river for a drink, then hurried to take a position beside Atiaran. Something in the set of her features seemed to ask him not to talk, so he disciplined himself to stillness with survival drills. Then he strove to regain the mechanical ticking stride which had carried him so far from Haven Farm. Atiaran appeared resigned to a trek of 300 leagues, but he was not. He sensed that he would need all his leper's skills to hike for even a day without injuring himself. In the rhythm of his steps, he struggled to master the unruliness of his situation. He knew that eventually he would have to explain his peculiar danger to Atiaran. He might need her help, at least her comprehension. But not yet. Not yet. He did not have enough control.
But after a while, she changed direction, began angling away from the river up into the northeastern foothills. This close to the mountains, the hills were steep and involuted, and she seemed to be following no path. Behind her, Covenant scrambled up and staggered down the rocky, twisting slopes, though the natural lay of the land tried constantly to turn them westward. The sides of his neck started to ache from the weight of his pack, and twitches jumped like incipient cramps under his shoulder blades. Soon he was panting heavily and muttering against the folly of Atiyaran's choice of directions. Toward mid-morning, she stopped to rest on the downward curve of a high hill. She remained standing, but Covenant's muscles were trembling from the exertion, and he dropped to the ground beside her, breathing hard. When he had regained himself a little, he panted, "Why didn't we go around? North past these hills, then east. Save all this up and down." "Two reasons," she said shortly. "Ahead, there is a long file north through the hills. Easy walking so that we will save time. And again," she paused while she looked around, "we may lose something. Since we left the bridge, there has been a fear in me that we are followed."
"Followed?" Covenant jerked out. "Who?"
"I do not know. It may be that the spies of the Grey Slayer are already abroad. It is said that his highest servants, his ravers, cannot die while he yet lives. They have no bodies of their own, and their spirits wander until they find living beings which they can master. Thus, they appear as animals or humans, as chance allows, corrupting the life of the land. But it is my hope that we will not be followed through these hills. Are you rested? We must go."
After adjusting her robe under the straps of her pack, she set off again down the slope. A moment later, Covenant went groaning after her. For the rest of the morning, he had to drive himself to persevere in the face of exhaustion. His legs grew numb with fatigue, and the weight on his back seemed to constrict his breathing so that he panted as if he were suffocating. He was not conditioned for such work. Lurching unsteadily, he stumbled up and down the hills. Time and again, only his boots and tough trousers saved him from damage. But Atiyaran moved ahead of him smoothly, with hardly a wasted motion or false step, and the sight of her drew him onward. But finally she turned down into a long ravine that ran north as far as he could see, like a cut in the hills. A small stream flowed down the center of the file, and they stopped beside it to drink, bathe their faces, and rest. This time, they both took off their packs and dropped to the ground. Groaning deeply, Covenant lay flat on his back with his eyes closed. For a while he simply relaxed, listened to his own hoarse respiration until it softened and he could hear behind it the wind whistling softly. Then he opened his eyes to take in his surroundings. He found himself looking up 4,000 feet at Kevin's watch. The view was unexpected. He sat up as if to look at it more closely. The watch was just east and south from him, and it leaned out into the sky from its cliff face like an accusing finger. At that distance, the stone looked black and fatal, and it seemed to hang over the file down which he and Atiyaran would walk. It reminded him of the Despiser and darkness.
"Yes," Atiyaran said, "that is Kevin's watch. There stood Kevin Landwaster, High Lord and Wielder of the Staff, direct descendant of Beric Halfhand, in the last battle against the Grey Slayer. It is said that there he knew defeat and mad grief. In the blackness which whelmed his heart, he, the most powerful champion in all the ages of the land, even he, High Lord Kevin, sworn Earth Friend, brought down the desecration, the end of all things in the land for many generations. It is not a good omen that you have been there."
As she spoke, Covenant turned toward her and saw that she was gazing not up at the rock, but inward, as if she were considering how badly she would have failed in Kevin's place. Then abruptly she gathered herself and stood up. "But there is no help for it," she said. "Our path lies under the shadow of the watch for many leagues. Now we must go on." When Covenant moaned, she commanded, "Come. We dare not go slowly, for fear that we will be too late at the end. Our way is easier now. And if it will help your steps, I will talk to you of the land." Reaching for his pack, Covenant asked, "Are we still being followed?" "I do not know. I have neither heard nor seen any sign. But my heart misgives me. I feel some wrong upon our path this day." Covenant pulled on his pack and staggered, wincing, to his feet. His heart misgave him also, for reasons of its own. Here, under Kevin's watch, the humming wind sounded like the thrum of distant vulture wings. Settling the pack straps on his raw shoulders, he bent under the weight and went with Atiyaran down the bottom of the file. For the most part, the cut was straight and smooth floored, though never more than 15 feet across. However, there was room beside the narrow stream for Atiyaran and Covenant to walk together. As they traveled, pausing at every rare Aliantha to pick and eat a few berries, Atiyaran sketched in a few of the wide blanks in Covenant's knowledge of the land. "It is difficult to know how to speak of it," she began. "Everything is part of everything, and each question which I can answer raises 3 more which I cannot. My lore is limited to what all learn quickly in their first years in the lore's rot. But I will tell you what I can. Beric Hartthew's son was Damalon Giant Friend, and his son was Lorik Vile Silencer, who stemmed the corruption of the Demondim, rendering them impotent." As she spoke, her voice took on a cadence that reminded Covenant of her singing. She did not recite dry facts. She narrated a tale that was of sovereign importance to her, to the land. "And Kevin, whom we name Land Waster more in pity than in condemnation of his despair, was the son of Lorik, and High Lord in his place when the staff was passed on. For 1,000 years, Kevin stood at the head of the council, and he extended the earth friendship of the lords beyond anything known before in the land, and he was greatly honored. In his early years, he was wise as well as mighty and knowledgeable. When he saw the first hints that the ancient shadow was alive, he looked far into the chances of the future, and what he saw gave him cause to fear. Therefore, he gathered all his lore into 7 wards. 7 wards of ancient lore for land's protection, wall and door, and hid them, so that his knowledge would not pass from the land even if he and the old lords fell. For many, many long years the land lived on in peace. But during that time, the Grey Slayer rose up in the guise of a friend. In some way the eyes of Kevin were blinded, and he accepted his enemy as a friend and lord. And for that reason, the lords and all their works passed from the earth. But when Kevin's betrayal had brought defeat and desolation, and the land had lain under the bane for many generations, and had begun to heal, it called out to the people who lived in hiding in the wastes and the northern climes. Slowly they returned. As the years passed, and the homes and villages became secure, some folk traveled, exploring the land in search of half-remembered legends. And when they finally braved giant woods, they came to the old land of Seareach and found that the giants, rock brothers of the people of the land, had survived the ritual of desecration. There are many songs, old and new, praising the fealty of the giants. With good reason. When the giants learned that people had returned to the land, They began a great journey, sojourning over all the land to every new Stonedown and Woodhelven, teaching the tale of Kevin's defeat and renewing the old Rock Brotherhood. Then, taking with them those people who chose to come, the Giants ended their journey at Revelstone, the ageless castle city which they had riven out of the rock of the mountain for High Lord Damelon as surety of the bond between them. At Revelstone, the Giants gave a gift to the gathered people. They revealed the First Ward, the fundamental store of the beginnings of Kevin's lore. For he had trusted it to the Giants before the last battle, and the people accepted that ward and consecrated themselves, swearing earth friendship and loyalty to the power and beauty of the land. One thing more they swore: peace, a calmness of self to protect the land from destructive emotions like those that maddened Kevin. For it was clear to all there gathered that power is a dreadful thing, and that the knowledge of power dims the seeing of the wise. When they beheld the First Ward, they feared a new desecration. Therefore they swore to master the lore, so that they might heal the land, and to master themselves, so that they would not fall into the anger and despair which made Kevin his own worst foe. These oaths were carried back to all the people of the land, and all the people swore. Then the few who were chosen at Revelstone for the great work took the First Ward to Kurash Plenathor, Stricken Stone, where the gravest damage of the last battle was done. They named the land Trothgard as a token of their promise of healing, and there they founded the Lorsrot, a place of learning where they sought to regain the knowledge and power of the old lords and to train themselves in the oath of peace. Then Atiaran fell silent, and she and Covenant walked down the file in stillness, textured by the whispering of the stream and by the occasional calls of the birds. He found that her tale did help him to keep up their pace. It caused him to forget himself somewhat, forget the raw ache of his shoulders and feet. And her voice seemed to give him strength. Her tale was like a promise that any exhaustion born in the land's service would not be wasted. After a time, he urged her to continue. "Can you tell me about the Lorsrot?" The bitter vehemence of her reply surprised him. "Do you remind me that I am, of all people, the least worthy to talk of these matters? You, Thomas Covenant, unbeliever and white gold wielder, do you reproach me?" He could only stare dumbly at her, unable to fathom the years of struggling that filled her spacious eyes. "I do not need your reminders." But a moment later she faced northward again, her expression set to meet the north. "Now, you reproach me indeed," she said. "I am too easily hurt that the whole world knows what I know so well myself. Like a guilty woman, I fail to believe the innocence of others. Please pardon me. You should receive better treatment than this." Before he could respond, she forged ahead. "In this way I describe the Lorsrot. It stands in Trothgard in the Valley of Two Rivers, and it is a community of study and learning. To that place go all who will, and there they consecrate themselves to earth friendship and the lore of the old lords. This lore is a deep matter, not mastered yet, despite all the years and effort that have been given to it. The chiefest problem is translation, for the language of the old lords was not like ours, and the words which are simple at one place are difficult at another. And after translation, the lore must be interpreted, and then the skills to use it must be learned. When I studied there, The lore wardens who taught me said that all the lore's rot had not yet passed the surface of Kevin's mighty knowledge. And that knowledge is only a seventh part of the whole, the first ward of seven.
Covenant heard an unwitting echo of Fowl's contempt in her words, and it made him listen to her still more closely.
"Easiest of translation," she went on, "has been the war lore, the arts of battle and defense.